Good afternoon. It's great to be here with you. And I've been looking forward to this, first of all, because it's such a good idea. I mean, just from time to time, there are things we need to talk about, which means we need to gather together and set aside the time and establish the priority. And when you think about all the things that might demand our attention, it's hard to come up with one more important than this: marriage and ministry. I want to express appreciation to Randy Stinson for his leadership in bringing this about, to the Bethencourt family for making this possible, and making it possible to you. I hope you understand, at no charge, everything that it costs to put this together, including feeding you, made possible by all of this, and by the Bethencourt family, and by this institution's priority to make such an opportunity available to us all. I am honored to speak with others on the program, including Dennis Rainey and Russell Moore, my dear friend C.J. Mahaney. Last night, C.J. asked, he said, "Why do I go last?" And I told him, because I said, if you didn't, none of the rest of us would get to speak. And that's just because he has so much to say. And, you know, we're all unbound by different things. CJ's unbound by the dimensions of time and space. And he just sort of levitates through time. And, I mean, once was, he was in Baltimore. Now he's in Louisville. And what a grace of God that such a friend has come to be with us so close. And I look forward to hearing him. And I'm actually making the point that it may be that I need to pay more attention to the clock, because there is so much on the calendar today. When I was a student, I came here, as you did, and went through all the normal stuff. And a lot of that stuff hasn't changed a great deal in terms of what you do. And there was a student meeting, and I went to the student meeting, and I was all fired up. I was single. I didn't want to stay that way. In fact, I had very definitive plans about how I wasn't going to stay that way. But at that point, I was single, and I went to this. And it's one of those times where I just went because it was a scheduled meeting. It looked like I ought to be there. So I got there, and the guy got up. He was 184, and he got up and started talking to us about planning our retirement. Okay, I was 20. I owned a 1974 Mustang, which was the pride of my life. That's right, as an automobile, it was there. Now, as my dear wife will point out to me, to my now shame, it was powder blue, but it was the one that was available to me, and I had it, and I drove it, made my way up here with a U-Haul trailer behind me with my prized possession. I know this is like Nerds R Us convention. There's my prized possession in the trailer behind my Mustang was a four-drawer filing cabinet. All right? You got the picture. And now you understand why I wasn't married while I got here. But nonetheless, I got here with the Mustang, with the filing cabinet, and that was pretty much what I owned, along with a few books. And my retirement plan was completely off of my vision. Now, I'm not suggesting it should have been, but it was. And so I can remember speaking to an older faculty member who has now gone to be with the Lord and who was very kind to me. I remember saying to him, "Boy, that was a waste of time." And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, "Your heart and mind is like a bank. And if you think you can reach into it when you need something and make a withdrawal that hasn't been deposited, you're a fool." He said, "You need to put all the deposits that you can there available for when you need it." And for some of you, thinking about ministry crises, that's pretty much what it is. I recognize that I'm speaking, hoping that what I have to say and what Mary will say with me will be something like an investment in the bank for you, for when you will need it. And I pray that by God's grace it might help at that time. Some of you, however, might be hanging on somewhere right now. And so I speak to you, even as I pray for you, that the Lord will see you and your marriage through this. By God's grace, that's the confidence we have as we're here together. I want us to open the Word of Scripture. And this from Luke chapter 8. The Gospel of Luke chapter 8. Familiar passage. One day he got into a boat with his disciples and he said to them, "Let's go across to the other side of the lake." So they set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. And a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in danger. And they went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased, and there was a calm. He said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were afraid, and they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this, that he commands even winds and water, and they obey him?" Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. The most popular American artist of the 20th century is someone many of you in this room may not even recognize by name, but you would recognize his art. His name was Norman Rockwell. He painted thousands of paintings that were, by any measure, the most widely viewed artistic pieces of the 20th century. He was the main cover artist for a magazine known as the Saturday Evening Post, which was at the time one of the mainstays of American culture. The 20th century was one of the most tumultuous cultures of human history. It's hard to imagine just how many revolutions took place. Two just absolutely massive world wars, revolutions, and of course, those revolutions were not only military and political and national, but they were moral and cultural as well. But through all of this, through the period of the Second World War and then after the war, through the era of the Cold War, of all the moral and cultural tumult of the 1960s and beyond, Norman Rockwell kept painting the same kind of painting. And the intellectual and creative elites absolutely dismissed him. You'll recognize his art because it's simple human art, realistic, largely domestic art. He painted pictures of families eating supper, of a grandfather and his grandson fishing, of a little boy nervous as he was about to get a vaccination, of a little girl staring into the face of a puppy. And Americans amongst the cultural elites, they just dismissed him, saying, "This is escapism. This is just nothing more than kitsch. This isn't art. Art makes a great moral statement. Art is like Picasso's Guernica during the Spanish Civil War. Art is that which presents all the darkness. Art represents something avant-garde." And Norman Rockwell just sat away painting his paintings. Now, more lately, he's come into greater artistic appreciation, although we didn't live to see it, and I don't think we'd care a great deal about it. But this is what Norman Rockwell knew, that those who derided him didn't know. And that's that in the midst of war, in the midst of cultural and sexual and moral revolutions, in the midst of riots on the college campuses, and in the midst of recessions and economic depressions and all the rest, what mattered most was human beings and their marriages and their families, and parents' love for their children, and spouses' love for each other, and young people sitting at a quaint picture of a soda fountain, looking in each other's eyes and holding hands as he's trying to summon the courage to ask her to marry him. You look at this and you recognize it was Norman Rockwell that actually understood life. It was Norman Rockwell's art that actually depicted this, because at the end of the day, after all the wars are over and after all the cultural tumult has settled or moved on to the latest tumult, what matters is what's domestic, Or at least that's what matters most intimately and intensely to us. And as Christians, we understand this in a larger biblical and theological framework because we understand that marriage and family are given to us by our Creator as not only that which is best for us and leads to human flourishing, but because He loves us and by His grace has created us to need each other. It was God Himself who said it is not good for man to be alone. It was the Creator who made that declaration. Adam didn't say that about himself. It was said of him by the one who knew him better than he knew himself. And in the biblical worldview, goodness and the transcendentals, the good, the beautiful, and the true, are centered magnificently, quintessentially, infinitely, and perfectly in God Himself, but they are demonstrated in the things He has given us by His grace. And those include marriage and family. They also include ministry. Unabashedly, we are here for a conference about strengthening marriage in ministry, because what makes this conversation unique is the fact that we are here because of the calling of God to serve the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. And we need to recognize that in the history of the Christian church, there has been a great deal of some overt debate and some obvious confusion about how those two things are to be related. I mean, after all, let's remember that what we have just in the history of the church is such things as priestly celibacy in the Roman Catholic Church. The argument for priestly celibacy, as in the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church, has to do with the sacerdotal role of the priest as imaging and representing priesting Christ. Well, we have a category error there. Christ is our great high priest. We have no other priest. But pragmatically and practically, the argument for priestly celibacy in the Roman Catholic Church is that being celibate, being unmarried, the priest is then freed from the concerns of being a husband and a father and then can give himself unrestrictedly, completely devotedly to the things of God and to the task of ministry. Well, I think not only is the idea of priestly celibacy theologically wrong because it is based upon a fundamentally erroneous understanding of the minister as a priest, I think it's fundamentally wrong about what makes for effectiveness in ministry. We have a biblical background that's important to us, of course. The normative picture of the minister as presented in the New Testament is that he, that is the one who holds the teaching office, is the husband of one wife. Both of those words are important. One and wife. One modifies wife. Wife does not modify one. So let's start with wife. Very clearly, even as Paul is writing to Timothy, even as the same teaching is reflected in his letter to Titus, the Apostle Paul, who, as we can best understand, is not married during his apostolic ministry, when he is appointing pastors of the churches, as God is calling pastors of the churches, those who are teaching elders, those who will bear the teaching responsibility, when it comes to their normative picture, he says, Timothy, be the husband of one wife. Many years ago in this chapel, right in this place, in the midst of the crisis and controversy about which I'm going to speak, we had a decisive moment, and that moment was when Dr. W.A. Criswell came here to preach. It was a couple of years after we had started the process of transforming this institution, and I'll be honest, I didn't invite some people until we had made at least some progress. Simply because everything was so volatile, and I wasn't going to invite my friends to share share the insults until at least there was someone friendly here to welcome them. And Dr. W.A. Criswell was, of course, a graduate of this institution, holding both degrees all the way up to the Ph.D. He was pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, and was probably our most famous living alumnus at the time. And of course, he was a famous warrior for truth and an expository pastor and a titanic personality simply doesn't adequately describe the man. He was like a walking civilization. And he got up to preach, and I said, on what are you going to preach? He said, I'm going to preach on the inerrancy of Scripture. That's good. Lay it down. Napalm. I mean, just carpet bomb for the inerrancy of Scripture. And he could do it. I'd seen him do it. If you haven't seen him do it, you need to go over to the library, or you need to go to wacriswell.com, and I'll tell you what sermons you need to listen to, and you're going to think, I may never have heard a sermon before. But he got up to preach right here, and I started to say this pulpit, but that would not be true. The pulpit that normally stands here, this is that which was formerly known as pulpit. But I do know, I don't, I'm not, it's not a criticism, I kind of like it. This is T4G and all the rest. It's all right, we're making a statement here. We're transparent. I mean, it's right. We're all here. All right. But Dr. Criswell got up to the pulpit, and he got up and he said, I'm going to preach on Timothy, get thee a wife. All right. He did. He got up here, the one shot he had. And with everybody, tensions high, everybody waiting, he just told me he's going to preach on the inerrancy of Scripture. He gets up here and says, I'm going to preach on Timothy, get thee a wife. And he did. Afterwards, I asked that question that you ask after you've been told someone's going to preach on one thing, you preach on something else. I said, Dr. Criswell, what led you to do that? He said, I looked out there, and I looked at those students, and I thought, they need a wife. So I preached on, Timothy, get thee a wife. All right. He was right. They needed a wife. I'm going to tell you honestly, 20 years later, I know in a whole new way what he means by that, because I can tell a couple of things pretty soon after meeting someone. One of them is if he's married. There's just a different focus, a different frame of reference. It comes naturally with it. We could infer many dimensions of that are appropriate and vital for ministry, but the normative picture of the minister in the New Testament is one who is married, wife, and that modifier is important too, one. Because even though the pastor is not a priest with a sacerdotal responsibility, he is to be an illustration of the gospel and of the fidelity of covenantal love. And that number one, in terms of its inescapable meaning, represents that covenantal commitment and the integrity and fidelity of that love. So I am assuming two realities as I speak to you today. The first is marriage, but the second isn't ministry, it's a crisis in ministry. If the Lord has called you to the ministry, He's called you to a ministry that will undoubtedly at some point involve crisis. Now, I have to tell you, as president of this institution, one of the things I worry about every time someone gets up to preach, it's not so much if he's going to preach a different sermon than he said he was going to tell me. He told me he was going to preach. It's I don't want people getting up here and unburdening themselves about all the frightening things that happen to you in ministry. For a time, I don't know what it was, but for some reason several years ago, we had a succession of pastors that got up here and said, I just want to talk to you about overcoming depression in ministry. You know, this is not a place to do therapy on yourself. And you talk about missing an audience, you look at it in an audience where every tail is wagging. And you say, I'm going to talk about depression in ministry? That's ridiculous. You don't look at a bunch of happy people and say, you need to know about depression. Well, again, in one sense, every once in a while, something like that can be helpful in the bank. And undoubtedly, you get any large group of people, there are going to be some people who need to hear that right now. But I am very concerned that as we get older in ministry, one of the things we often do, especially when we think about talking to a congregation like this, is that we say, I want to warn you about what's coming. Huh? I want to prepare you. I don't want you to be surprised when this happens. And I will tell you, I've never had a depressed moment in my life. Never. It's not to say I haven't been disappointed. It's not to say I haven't been frustrated. It's not to say I haven't been tempted in my own carnality and my own sinfulness sometimes to think, all right, we're just going to cash this in, whatever it is, little project, big project, or whatever. But I've never been depressed. And by the way, let me tell you, one of the reasons I've never been depressed is because I belong to Jesus. That's the main reason. But the second reason I've never been depressed is because I'm married. More about that later. At this point, I want to tell you that crisis in ministry is not something I want to hold up like this is some exercise in ministerial scared straight. Not that I've ever had this experience, but some of you may have had the experience where you had to go to traffic school. And I've heard that if you have had that experience, that what happens is that they will often show you movies of car crashes, which are supposed to lead you to be instantly inspired to drive safely. I'm not sure how efficacious that is. That means effective. I'm not sure exactly how powerful that is as an actual teaching tool, but I do know, you kind of remember the crashes. I'm not here to hold up before you a series of car crashes, not at all. Nor do I want to suggest in any way that what ministry is all about is a series of crashes, or even of just problems. And you know what it's like to be in a family. You know what it's like to be in a church. You know that we're talking about human beings. There will be issues. But when we talk about crises in the sense of the talk that's my responsibility today, I'm talking about one of those things that just comes and you know it's definitive for who you are and for your ministry. You know that this is going to determine who you are or reveal who you are like nothing else. You know that this is going to determine what your church or your ministry is going to be like, not only for the present but for the future. And you know that this is a definitive moment when you're simply going to have to do what you have to do. I'm reluctant to talk too often about what I'm going to talk about today. And it's for a couple of reasons that I want to share with you. As a matter of fact, oddly enough, I think the only time I've ever in public talked about many of these things in depth was for a Sovereign Grace Pastors Conference years ago. One of the reasons I don't want to do that is not because I'm just so naturally, wonderfully humble, but because I'm scared of telling stories that just center in my role and that particular era. There's another reason which a lot of people sometimes don't think about. I actually don't want to live there the rest of my life. It was undoubtedly necessary. Of that, I'm unshakably certain. And I am so thankful the Lord saw us through it as he did, to his glory. But I don't want to go back and live there. I sometimes hear people that live through wars or great things, and they say, you know, this horrible conflict, so, you know, that I want to go back there. That, they don't say it necessarily, but that's what it looks like. I don't want to go back there. But to the glory of God, we need to go back and trace some steps. You know enough to know that this institution was at a crucial point in 1993 when I was elected, that given the conservative resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention, this is one of the last institutions to face the changes brought about by faithful Southern Baptists who demanded that their institution stand without apology upon the inerrancy of Scripture and the faith once for all delivered to the saints. You know enough to know that this institution quite publicly had set itself against that movement and against that mandate, and had done all that it knew to do, politically and in every other way, institutionally, to make sure it could not happen here. But as Southern Baptists continued to send their messengers to the convention, and they continued to vote to affirm the faith once for all delivered to the saints, to affirm those truths that are so unquestionably revealed in Scripture and so central to our faith, when they continued to send messengers to affirm the inerrancy of Scripture and to appoint trustees who would then require the same of the institutions, the tipping point came in the third quarter of the year 1992, and I was elected in an absolutely stunning series of events, quite honestly, in March of 1993. I was preaching this past Sunday in Marietta, Georgia, land at Atlanta Airport. One of my interns was with me, and we got to Atlanta fairly late, later than we had planned, and we were just going to get the rental car and pass the Marriott at the Atlanta Airport. I said, "Do you see that hotel?" Well, of course he saw it. Chris Parrish was the intern's right there. He's not blind. There it is. And I said, "I was elected president of Southern Seminary in that hotel." The situation was so volatile that they couldn't even hold the board meeting to elect me, not only on this campus, they couldn't hold it in Louisville. I was elected in Atlanta, Georgia, when the trustees gathered together at the Marriott Airport there, at the hotel at the Atlanta Airport, and I was elected there. And I look back at it, and I have to wonder, what were they thinking? I was 33 years old, and I mean, kind of barely 33. I had a wife who was younger than I, and we had two tiny children. And they were looking to transform an entire institution, and there were so many qualified people they could have chosen, but by God's grace, they chose me. And I want to tell you, I'll admit to you right front, I wanted to do it. I felt a calling to do it. I felt an urgency to do it. I had felt that for years. Sometimes you just know there's something that God in His sovereignty put into your DNA, and you just think, "I'm supposed to do that." And they came and asked me to do it. And they didn't have to wait for an answer. And then we had to do it. I was elected in March, and as I say, it was so volatile, I couldn't even be elected here. But they arranged for me to fly here the night I was elected for a press conference. And it's difficult, I think, for the folks who are here now to imagine what it was like. This was like an armed camp. There were helicopters continually over the campus with news organizations. There were press conferences, and there was just an enormous, well, critical nature, like everything's about to explode at every moment. So I walked in this press conference, which is over in the Carver Building in Ingram Hall, and I walked in, and there are all these reporters, television cameras, and all the rest, and angry people. They were not at all happy that I'd been elected president of Southern Seminary. And so this is one of those moments when you have to kind of be gracious, but at the same time, then the questions started. By the way, my favorite question of all, I was asked a lot of mean questions. I was asked a couple of smart questions, but I was also asked some incredibly stupid questions. The most stupid question I got, and at this point you have to realize, I had just gone that very day through 12 hours of questioning by the Board of Trustees before I was elected. We had started out, we'd gone from early in the morning, and this is getting towards late at night, and I'd had to fly here, and we're here, the chairman of the board, chairman of the search committee standing beside me, and this one reporter had been waiting all day to ask me, no kidding, this question. He looked at me and said, "Dr. Moeller, you're 33 years old. That's very young. What do you intend to do about it?" Well, I'll admit that I was kind of at the end of my patience and the end of my eloquence, for that matter. I looked at him and said, "I intend to age." Now, I just want to tell you that I've made many promises in my life. Never have I made one that I have fulfilled so spectacularly and visibly. Yeah, it happened. That's right. And when I arrived here, you realize the average age of a student was older than I was. It's not a sign of health for an institution, but that's where it was. And I aged in many ways. Chronologically is easy to trace. Aging the other way is a little more difficult to trace. The mechanics of the change we had to bring about had to do with the fact that we had to go through a process, first of all, of articulating the reality. In my book on leadership coming out, I quote Max Dupree, who says, you know, very simply, the task of leadership is a long line between two poles, two polarities. The first one is defining reality, and the last one saying thank you. Defining reality is one of the hardest things you do in ministry. It's one of the hardest things you actually do in life. It's one of the reasons why some of you aren't yet engaged, because you're not ready to define reality. All right, let me push you over the edge. Define reality. Ask her. But here's the reality. I had to look to an institution and say, we're going to fundamentally change. It's not like a 90-degree turn. It was a 180-degree turn. And the crucial moment for me, other than all the press conferences and all the rest, after I've been president-elect for several excruciating months, that is a horrible thing. President-elect, that's a very awkward position. Once the -elect was taken off, my first responsibility was opening convocation. And I preached a message entitled, "Don't Just Do Something, Stand There," on Southern Seminary's a confessional institution. And I had said all the things publicly before, but what I did at that time was simply to walk through the abstract of principles and make very clear, this is what you've already signed that you say you believe. You've already signed it. But some of you are already clearly teaching outside of it. I set down the history. I set down the parameters. I set down the contractual and theological and moral obligations. I set down the responsibility of this institution to the Southern Baptist Convention. And then I went through the abstract of principles article by article, excruciating to the crowd. Now, when I was doing this, the Student Government Association was sitting right out here in the center, and they decided that their proper response during my presentation was to stand up and turn their backs to me. That was kind. The faculty didn't turn their backs to me. They glared at me. I kind of wish they'd switched roles. But nonetheless, I'm standing here, and many of these were my own teachers, and it was very difficult. Now, we'd already gone through a couple of press conferences in which Mary had been here with me, and a couple in which I'd been alone. Let me tell you, having her with me was better. But she was here in that first convocation, and I remember telling her the day before, well, we're going to find out how bad it's going to be tomorrow. We found out. I had a delegation from the senior faculty. Back then, we had a senior faculty group known as the Faculty Committee. And they asked to see me. Ask is not really the word. They demanded to see me. And I had preached the message, and then I had gone back to my office alone. No one walked with me. I walked back alone and walked into my office and closed the door and sat down and knew the execution committee would be coming. And Mary knew it as well. And it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon when they came. And they came and they sat down, seven of them. They sat down in my office and they said, Mr. President, what you did today in chapel is intellectually indefensible, theologically egregious. It was contractually and legally offensive. We have the right to determine what the abstract of principles means for ourselves. You don't have the right to tell us what the abstract of principles means. The Board of Trustees doesn't have the right to tell us what the confession means. The convention itself doesn't have the right to tell us what the convention means. I'll tell you what the convention means. And then one faculty member to whom I'd been very close at one time, a man that I'd known ever since I was a boy, and he'd come preaching at my home church, he was a classic postmodernist. And he said to me, he said, you know, the problem is that you think truth is some objective reality, something that can be correctly defined. He said, and the author of the abstract of principles is dead. It's a dead document. It is alive only in our interpretation and in our interpretive engagement with the horizon of the text in which we have this critical engagement. And he looked at me and he said, do you have a response to that? And this is one of those moments when I knew the next words were going to define everything. So I looked at him and I said, you're fired. Oh, this was not this was not what you might think it was. This was not like, go ahead, make my day. I mean, this was not when I was looking into his eyes saying, you know, go ahead, do this. This was one of those moments where you say something and then you kind of see the words just kind of going out. And everything's in slow motion, and it's like one of those dreams where you're being chased by a bear and you can't go anywhere. And then the words landed. And this professor said, you can't do that. And I said, well, why can't I do that? He said, I have a contract that says you can't just fire me. And I said, hey, contract's just a text. It's dead. We all have a right to interpret it any way we want to interpret it. But he was right. He was right. I didn't have the power just to immediately fire a tenured faculty member. We had to go through a process of orderly investigation, due process. But that was the defining moment, I can tell you now. The defining moment wasn't at a press conference. It wasn't when the trustees elected me. That set everything in motion. The decisive moment came down to when I had to say to someone, you're not going to be here long. And that represents everyone who does not stand in fidelity to the document you signed as a confession of faith, pledging publicly to teach in accordance with and non-contrary to all that is contained therein, with no hesitation or mental reservation or no private arrangement with the one who invests you in office. Yeah, that's kind of tattooed in my mind. I can recite that. You know, if I'm ever put under water torture, I don't know what else I'm going to know, but I'm going to know that language. We went through this thing, and again, after chapel, who did I care thought what about that address? Well, I was delivering it to the faculty. What I want to know is what Mary thought. And when that faculty committee left, and I had gone through an instant energy reduction and was kind of reduced just to sitting in my chair thinking, did that just happen? I got to go home to Mary and to Katie and Christopher. Katie was 4. Christopher was 1. And that house is right there. And there's no way to get away from it. It's not like we could go hide. We're right there. But when I went inside that house, it was a different world than the world I inhabited over here. There was a little 4-year-old girl who wasn't at all reluctant to make clear how glad she was Daddy was home, and a little 1-year-old boy who was very much the same, and a wife who was with me in this completely from beginning to end, but didn't love me as president of Southern Seminary, loved me as her husband. We went through several years like that. It was really 3 years of intense kind of hand-to-hand close action combat. And there were so many horrible things that happened during that. And I do not want to sit here and, you know, do old war reels of all that went on. But we went through, you know, about 3 months, about 90 to 100 days of students sitting in outside my office singing We Shall Overcome. They didn't, but nonetheless, they sang it with gusto. We went through all kinds of things. We went through having protests all over the place. And you know, this is funny. How do you grow up when your daddy is followed by people yelling at him? You know, and all this. But when these kids were so young, by God's grace, I am so thankful that my children weren't teenagers during all this. They might have been horribly hurt, and they might have come out of this cynical. They were just little. And one of God's graces in that is, for instance, when they hold a candlelight vigil to protest you outside your house, a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old think it's a party. And it was completely lost on them. The only problem was I was afraid I was going to look out there, and they were going to be singing, "We shall overcome." You know, didn't want them to switch sides. But nonetheless, God's grace was in the fact they were young, and they have been with us in conviction from as early as they were able, but from the very beginning, they were just with us because they were with us. we went through some horrifying moments that you can only go back to even in memory every once in a while, because it's just not healthy to go back there. We had personal betrayals that were near catastrophic. I mean, when you have people who are just close friends, the kind of people you think, you know, that you're close enough with that if something happened to you, you know, they could take care of your kids, and then they cut you off because of what was going on here and don't even return your mail, don't have anything to do with you anymore. You know, folks who were in your wedding and folks, in my case, I'd grown up with since we were in middle school, just all over. Not going to have anything to do with what's going on there. And internally, you're going to find there are going to be disappointments when you're in a crisis, because you're going to discover that people respond to crises in different way. And one of the ways that some people respond to a crisis is they just disappear. You're going to discover in the midst of a crisis who your friends are, because there's going to be one standing with you. I felt like Moses a lot of the time. Not in the good way. I just felt like I was parting the Red Sea and walking alone. But all the people would go swoosh, swoosh. They would make the way straight. They didn't want to walk with me. They didn't want to be seen with me. It wasn't true of everyone here, by the way. I want to make that clear. There were a couple of folks here, a handful of folks here, some of whom are still here, I'm thankful to say, who weren't embarrassed to side with the truth and with confessional fidelity and with the vision for this institution. But by and large, what we saw between 93 and 96, 97 was a complete exchange of people. I don't want to ask Mary, I'm thinking about this is thinking in front of you, I don't want to ask her what her worst moments were, but I'm going to guess that commencement had to be one of them, because she had to sit here while we had to get rid of a lot of students. And it takes some of them a while to get out. It takes them a while to finish their degree programs, longer, because I thought, hey, I get here in 93, end of students be gone by 96. Not exactly. And then there were doctoral students who were just hanging on, like, you know, just never leaving. And so we went through 10 years. In fact, it was a little more than that. A little more than 10 years where I had to worry as I was handing out diplomas. Worry is the wrong word. I just had to be prepared for the fact there were people who weren't going to shake my hand, which, by the way, is very hard not to do since I've got the diploma in the other hand. Generally, even people who don't like you will shake hands with you because they've been working hard for that piece of paper you've got in the other hand. And then it was worse than that. We had protests. I was giving a commencement address one year when all these horrible banners came flying down from the balcony. And you just think, you know, you got to really, really, really reach some kind of point where you're willing to interrupt your own commencement for a protest. And we had so many people who wouldn't speak to us. And then we had their friends would come to see him graduate. So again, it was just public event after public event. And just constant. Again, I don't go back there very often because every single day was a bad day in its own way. But the Lord had clearly a purpose for this institution. I was absolutely convinced on the other side of it, we could build the kind of school I would want to attend and I would want to make available to a generation sold out for the gospel, ready to take the gospel of Christ to the nations, wanting to come to an institution that would stand without apology for the inerrancy of Scripture, for the faith once for all delivered to the saints, for confessional fidelity. And in the middle of the thing, every day had its bad moments for a long time, but there were graced moments as well. And for me, the most important graced moments didn't take place on this side of Lexington Road, but on the other side. I want to lay out just a few principles for you. I'm humbled to say I do not have 40. I come with a quarter of what Dennis had, only 10. The first is your marriage and your ministry are inseparable. That's not an uncontroversial statement. I can tell you that those who taught me and even many of the pastors I know would either argue or try to argue that that is not so. But I want to tell you it is true. Your marriage and your ministry are inseparable because your marriage is who you are. And that commitment you've made in covenant fidelity in marriage, or that commitment you're going to make, is a commitment prior to your acceptance of a call to any specific place of ministry. And that is a matter that is simply incontrovertible. You are not going to ever be able successfully to separate your ministry or your marriage, because if you think you're doing that, you're lying to yourself and you're setting yourself up for horrible disaster. Now, I have known pastors who've had bad marriages who were great expositors. I've known pastors that had tragic marriages that were able to do great things for the kingdom, but that was a clear limp at the very least. And at the end of, I've seen several of these come to the end of their ministry, and you realize there is something horrifyingly missing even now. We can't act as if our marriage and our ministry are inseparable. They're not, because we're not individually separable from our call, and we're not individually separable from our covenantal commitments. We are all the time. And if we suffer under the illusion that we can somehow set our marriage on one side and our ministry on the other side, and we can set them apart as two distinct dimensions of who we are, we fool ourselves. I think it's one of the reasons why, when you look at the pastoral epistles, you'll note that it's a comprehensive picture. It's not just husband of one wife. It's also an orderly household. It's also tied to being a man of good reputation for the one who is called to the teaching office in the church. It's even, as Titus makes clear, you know, and you find parallels in Timothy. It's with children who are living in a rightly ordered family and living rightly ordered lives before the world and before the church. There's no separation. We have built up an expectation among some that the ministry is a profession such that you just show up and you do it. That is fundamentally unbiblical. It is downright heretical. It is injurious and disastrous for ministry, but it's also disastrous for the minister. Second, your marriage will anchor your ministry, never the other way around. Never for a minute think that your ministry is going to save your marriage. It won't. Now, your marriage can save your ministry, but your ministry will never save your marriage. If you think you can find greater fulfillment in your ministry that will compensate for what you don't have in your marriage, you're doomed. It has to work the other way around. If I had to leave home during that crisis in order to get over here to be happy, that would have been horrifying, not to mention disastrous. You got to get the order right. If you're going to be happy anyplace, be happy at home. And you have to make it an absolute priority to find happiness there. Your marriage will anchor your ministry. And that's so in so many dimensions, in terms of your personal integrity, in terms of how people know you, in terms of your credibility, in terms of your modeling of Christ. Your marriage will anchor your ministry, never the other way around. Third, your marriage will determine the state of your heart, not your ministry. It's very similar to point two, except we have to realize that the state of our heart is a very urgently important thing, because we're never higher than our heart. We can't live that way. We can try to say, I'm going to live at a level higher than my heart's currently existing, but it doesn't work. And marriage will determine the state of your heart. And I've known this not only because I believe it's clear in terms of a biblical worldview. I've known this because I have known so many pastors and so many Christian leaders who are at the absolute apex, at a climactic moment of their ministry, but they're not happy. Their heart isn't healthy, not because things aren't going well in the ministry, but because they aren't going well at home. Number four, your home is to be a haven in a heartless world. Quoting there from Christopher Lash, the cultural historian. He pointed out that one of the things we've done in modern society is that we've turned the home into something less than, even sociologically speaking, it has been for civilization. It has been the place where people found their greatest fulfillment, their greatest hope. It's been a haven in a heartless world. But instead, we have transformed the family. And again, he's not a Christian, not writing from a Christian worldview, writing from a secular sociological worldview. He says the problem is that given everything that's happened to the family that used to be the haven in a heartless world is now often just as heartless as the world around it. Making it a priority to build your family as truly a haven in a heartless world is very important. In other words, when you go out in the world, expect to be hurt. Ministry is a risk. You are exposing yourself to criticism. You are exposing yourself to injury. You know, you establish relationships with people you love, and then you feel let down by them. You just have to know that if your barometer, your spiritual health, if your heart's going to ride on that, you're going to face disaster. Your home has to be a haven in a world where, let's face it, you can get hurt at home, but you better not be hurt in the same way. It has to be the haven from those hurts. Fifth, your wife must be a partner in ministry, not a mere observer. And I think there are a lot of people who have witnessed ministry marriages where they draw the impression, sometimes the right, the truthful, accurate impression, that the wife is more an observer than a participant. That's not always true, because one of the things that is special between a husband and a wife, especially in ministry, is you can't always tell. You can tell if they love each other. You can tell if they're faithful to each other. But you can't always tell exactly how she is a partner with him. But if you get close, you see. If you get close, you can tell. She can't be a mere observer. If she is, then you're living in a bifurcated world that sets you up for disaster. Sixth, when crises come, lean on each other, drawing strength from each other. Just common sense. I mean, that's what marriage is all about. But a part of what I want to say there is that you lean on Christ and you lean on each other, and you've got to be very careful about leaning on anyone else. At least you have to know that Christ is fully adequate, and Christ in his grace has given you this spouse as the one onto whom you are to lean in terms of your earthly life, the one on whom you depend, the reference point, the centering reference point of your life in terms of an earthly relationship. And if you look for that somewhere else, you're going to be in big trouble. You have to draw strength from each other. And seventh, protect her heart and trust in God. Now, this may sound a little contradictory, and just given the time, I have to be here very fast, but if you think that what you're going to do is protect your wife from reality, that's not going to work. Again, that's making her an observer, or sometimes even a distant observer, not a participant. But if you take everything home to her in terms of all your hurts, just recognize you need to be careful not when you have a moment of anger or when you've been let down that you don't poison her view of someone horrifyingly. Because one of the things about me, I'll be honest, is I can be really frustrated with someone and want to promote them the next morning. But if I come home that night and I dump on somebody, they can be ruined with my wife forever. As a little warning to you all. But I mean that in a sweet way, because what she knows is what I tell her in that. And I have to be very careful not to poison that, but also to make her fully aware in the way that is appropriate. And she's always wanted to know just the right things for just the right reasons and to handle it in just the right ways. Ninth, protect your children. No, it's eighth, excuse me. Protect your children and interpret events for them and live confidently. In other words, your children don't need to have all the data. They don't need to be chess experts in the game of your ministry and what you're doing. They just need to know you're happy with mom and you're secure in your calling and that you're confident in Jesus, and do interpret events for them, but do it in a sweet, parental, theological way that points to the providence of God and the goodness of God, and also lets them at the appropriate age know they're going to get let down, but they don't cash in their chips. Ninth, if you have to choose, lose the ministry, not the marriage. And by the way, the second thing you say after that is, if you lose the marriage, you better lose the ministry anyway. But if it comes to that kind of point, recognize that if you, and I don't mean just because your wife doesn't want to live in this state or you got hurt feelings, you want to go home. I mean, if you realize, I can't do this, I can't stay here and stay married, then stay married. God's sovereign. If he's called you, you'll get to a place where you can stay both faithful in ministry and faithful in marriage. And tenth, aim to grow old and happy together. You know, the biblical picture here is really rich. In the Old Testament with the patriarchs and the matriarchs and the wisdom literature, aim to grow old together. and happy together. Plan a life from beginning to end together. I was preaching with Joe Stoll several years ago. He was then president of Moody. He's now president of Cornerstone University. Joe told me, he said, he'd had some kind of crisis through which he had gone, and it was very interesting what he had to say. And I'll never forget. I have forgotten the context, actually, but I haven't forgotten what he said. He said, I realized that I had better be investing most of my life in the ones who will be there with me after I'm not Dr. Stoll, President Stoll. When I don't have this ministry position anymore, I'm going to find out who my people are. And that starts with your spouse and your children. It starts at home. There's so much I want to tell you. I want to tell you this very quickly. I would not be here today if not for the grace of God in Mary Moeller. She made me better and makes me better every day than I otherwise would be. And I will tell you the truth, there never was a moment when I was ready to cash it all in here, but there were moments in which I was tempted to lose heart. And she never let me lose heart. She has been so totally invested in this institution from the beginning. The first thing she did was to model motherhood and being a wife. She was not those early years over here a great deal. She was over there doing what she was modeling for and what many people on this campus despised at that time, which was wasting her education and wasting her ambitions, they would say, in order to be over there as the wife of me and the mother of Katie and Christopher. And she was just so faithful day in and day out. And she also bore the scorn and despised the shame. And frankly, she's also a bit subversive. She knew when to show up with a baby stroller. That works too. And when the children were older, she started devoting herself over here, volunteering as the director of the Seminary Wives Institute, which has been the burden of her heart. And now we are empty nesters. It happens all too quickly. And she's able to be with me more. But it's not like she's now learning what I do for the first time. She's been with me all the way. I wouldn't be here without her. And I want to ask her to come up here with me for a few minutes. Are you serious? Thank you. Thank you so much. So, what did I not say I should have said?
Oh, mercy. You said that all so well, and were, am I on here? Was very, very kind and flattering to me, and I just appreciate that so very much. I'm supposed to be writing a book about this someday. I don't know if we'll ever get to that or not, but the Lord is very gracious in allowing a lot of those memories from 20 years ago to fade, I think partly because we're getting a little older. We're not old, but we're getting older. And so you can pinpoint conversations down to verbatim, which is amazing. There are certain scenes that are forever emblazoned in my heart that I will not forget. Graduation is one that you mentioned that was definitely poignant because I would sit right there twice a year and watch you. And my perspective was to watch you, and you'd have to smile each time as you extended your hand because you had no clue if this was going to be a troublemaker or not. And the way that so many of those graduate students of a seminary, this is not some secular graduate school, would just yank that diploma out of your hand, and just the look on your face was just gut-wrenching for me. And I can remember us, we would have guest speakers for graduation at that time, and we would have a luncheon afterwards at the house, and I can remember being over there, and we would just all kind of fall into the chair and say, well, we got through another one. And so year after year, those got better, but that was just, it's such a sharp contrast now to what we see, and God has been so gracious to bring us through that and to bring students and their wives and their families here now that are just amazing. I just can't say enough about what joy that brings to my heart to see the transition, and to see graduation be such a happy occasion. We cry now because we're sad to see these people go, but we know that's what's supposed to be the next step. One of the poignant things I remember time and time again would be when you would come home, and you didn't call me a lot during the day, and I didn't expect you to, but there'd be kind of a lull, and things would be kind of, you know, going along. And then you come home, and you come in the kitchen door, and dinner's ready, and the kid, you know, Christopher's in his high chair, and Katie's there with whatever she's got to tell you for the day. And you come in, and you have this look on your face. Mm. And it's a look I can't describe, but it's just a look that I knew as your wife. Okay, something else has happened. What knife in the back is there now? And we would have to get through dinner and realize, you know, we're not going to talk about this right now, but then we would go off after dinner, and it would be, you know, and the shock of it, you know, because I wouldn't see it coming. But I would see the look on your face, and it just, you know, as a wife, you understand to see him hurt is so much harder, I think, when you have no way to respond either. And so I did not have any kind of platform where I could come over here and, you know, I had a lot of Harry Truman letters, or not a lot, several that I wrote.
And you had a frying pan.
Yeah, I had a frying pan. But I can remember sending you those Harry Truman letters and you saying very graciously, thank you for those very nice things that you said, but don't send that. And I didn't, but it was therapeutic. I also think it's funny you left out one little part about the sit-ins, that only you would do this. But one particular time when there was this sit-in of these unruly people and there were songs and all that, he decides to order pizza for them, and he did. And he ordered pizza. And then when it came, and so the president's office was where Dr. Moore's office is now. And so all these pizzas came, and much to their amazement, you know, they were being passed out, and you were one of the ones that was passing it out. And one of the disgruntled professors was sitting there among them in the hallway and did not know how to respond to that. So that's another little jewel that
but
I
ate the pizza.
That I remember that ate the pizza.
That's
same,
right.
Same thing.
Well, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this question, but did you hear anything in there that you thought, you know, I think you saw that wrong?
And this is just a little disclaimer here. This is like the premier extemporaneous speaker on the planet right here, my husband. That's why this is slightly terrifying that he has called me up here and he would not tell me anything about what we're just going to talk. And being the submissive wife, here I am, you know, okay, honey, whatever you say. And now you're asking me if I need to correct anything.
No, I often wonder. Well, correct a word, but I often wonder, did I say anything in that? It's kind of a reality check that you thought, you know, I don't think it was. I mean, it may be not. I'm kind of hoping so, but.
No, I mean, from what the picture that I remember, that's very accurate. And if I could just add a couple of little things that
sure.
are related. Just and from the perspective of a minister's wife, I would just encourage you. I affirm totally. I want to jump on one thing you said about being partners in ministry, how important that is. So it's important for you to know what your role is and what it isn't. So yes, you are the partner in ministry. You are the only one that he can come home to. You're the only one who knows his heart, who sees him pouring himself into this position, who can pray for him like no one else can. But your role is not to be the co-pastor, or in my case, the co-president. Oh my goodness, can't even think about that. But I know some wives that get overwhelmed in the crisis situation because they're trying to be the co-pastor, and that is not their job. So you don't need to be at the deacons' meetings where all these bombs are going off. I was not at these faculty meetings where all kinds of stuff was happening, and that was wise. I did not need to be there. But realize that you are not the co-pastor, that he needs to do his job. Your job is to be providing that safe haven at home. Secondly, just make sure that you know those kids are watching, whether they're 1 and 4 or whether they're older. One of the most poignant papers I ever received from a student in one of my classes was an answer to the question, what concerns you the most? Like, what excites you the most is the one question. What concerns you the most about being a ministry wife? And she said, my concern is that I become my mother. And her father was a pastor. And her concern was that she would become her mother because she said, my mother is a bitter woman. And that was just so convicting to me and to all of us who have daughters that your daughter would never say that about you or that your son would ever not want to go into the ministry because he's seen what it has done to the family. And so that's a very, very a sobering word, and so I would just encourage you to not let that root of bitterness start springing up because it's so hard for that to be rooted out, but to trust the Lord and to know that he's just, you know, that no one's getting away with anything. You leave all the end results to him, and you realize that the Lord brings us through trials. Scripture's just replete with references to how that we've been brought through trials so that the testing of our faith is proven genuine. And there's great, great glory in that.
Now, you can speak about something I can only speak about theoretically. What about the mom thing in the midst of all this? What would you say to those who are going to be not only wives, but moms in the middle of a ministry crisis?
Again, what we've both been saying here is just to protect them, to make sure that you don't come in the door that night and just start laying all this out to where they grow up saying, there's no way I'm setting my family up for this. I'm running as far from this as possible. But that they see the interaction, but they're watching. Kids are so much more keen than we give them and perceptive than we sometimes give them credit for. So you deliberately, they're watching your response, even when it's a little crisis. You know, how does mom respond when we're supposed to be having family night tonight and some church members in intensive care and dad's got to go? Is mom rolling her eyes? Is mom huffing around, you know, acting like she's okay with this? Or is mom gathering us together and saying, kids, look, these people we love are in crisis. You know, we can do family night later. Let's pray for these people. And they're picking up your cues from that early on, and you're teaching them all kinds of lessons that will be very deep later.
Now, with the kids, for instance, just thinking all these things through, what would you say to a mom about, such things as this? Let's be very transparent here, okay? A part of the common wisdom often given to pastors is you should not be really close friends with those with whom you work. I just want you to know I'm completely at odds with that. I only want to work with people I consider to be close friends. And one of my greatest joys is working with the leaders of this institution that I have the joy of working with, and every single one of them. And it's true writ large of the institution, to be honest, but right in the executive cabinet, I would trust every one of those men with everything and want to be with them. And so what I want to point out to you is it is our children grew up with our ministry team here thinking of them as aunts and uncles, even more than their own aunts and uncles who are so far away.
It's a huge blessing to them, and they would tell you that to this day, for sure.
I mean, I think she will. She would not mind me saying this, but you know, when we've lost some people in the right way. We've had five or six more people leave our executive team and go to be presidents of other institutions and entities, and you know, it was something to have a teenage daughter cry that they would leave.
It's true, and you can still, I've said this before publicly, I can still make her cry if I want to on demand. All I've got to do is say his name, and she'll go, Mom. She'll suck it in. But it's very precious that they've had so many opportunities, and so I don't want you to leave here thinking, oh, those poor kids who grew up going through all of that. They also had many, many, many blessings. They got to meet Billy Graham. They've sat down at the table with Dr. Dobson and others, and I won't start calling too many names here, but they've had many privileges. They've watched their dad do some amazing things, and no one is prouder of him besides me than they are. And so there's great, great encouragement in that. But the fact that I've been able to have friends who are here, the amazing thing is when you assemble this stellar faculty, those men came with wives, and those wives have become dear, dear friends to me.
And children
who've become dear, dear friends
and
to
me. And I think
kids.
It's really sweet when the people with whom you work most closely, when your wives are dear friends, and when your kids develop those natural friendships, and it just don't rob yourself of that. Let me also tell you, not only does it come with tremendous blessings, you're going to need that because this is a long road, lots of twists and turns, and you're not going to make it alone. The last thing I want to ask you, Mary, is again, given part of what I appreciate you so much in terms of what you do here now is what you do for Seminary Wives. And I also want to say that I think we as an institution, our weak spot we've got to continually watch is given the fact that we're so committed to complementarianism because we believe that's God's glory and his plan for not only righteousness, but happiness. But that means that we're so committed to training pastors, and we do understand those are men, that we can be so zealous in doing the right thing, we can sometimes forget what we're talking about here today. So, you know, give us a few words and speak to wives in particular.
Well, Seminary Wives Institute starts this evening with record-breaking numbers, and we're so excited about that. And I hope to see those of you who are registered there this evening, okay? One of the class I'm teaching tonight is the start of the Essentials class, and one of the things that I share in that every year is how you have an opportunity as a student wife to take a man that may be, like, by the world standards, and this is not original with me, but someone that people just say, well, you know, he's mediocre. We don't expect him to set the world on fire. But you're the woman who is married to him. You're the one that sees the light on under the door till 3 a.m. as he's up studying Greek. You're the one that sees how he has a burden for the lost and how he's not looking for titles and accolades. He's just genuinely wanting to be the minister that God's called him to be.
And she sees the greatness in him.
She does, and she has the opportunity to pull a man who may look mediocre to the world up to greatness, and that's an awesome thing. I mean, you celebrate the seat he gets in Greek because, you know what, he's passing, and that's great. And then on the contrary, there are some guys that come in here may look like superstars, and everyone's saying, you know what, he's going to be the next president of this or that. And those wives sometimes feel like, you know what, I'm in the shadows. It's all about him. Nobody's really talking about me. Hello, I've got gifts too. So they, instead of building that man up, they start nitpicking at him. They start saying, well, that illustration you gave, you know, wasn't really accurate. Or, you know, they just do things to make sure they, quote, keep his ego in check. And a lot of times those women are used by Satan to take a man who's headed for greatness and pull him down to mediocrity because they make it their job to be the Holy Spirit to that man. And they don't take seriously their responsibility to love him and to encourage him and to be his greatest support. And so we see that, and it breaks our hearts in ministry when we'll see men that you say, well, what about this guy? Oh, no, his wife's a big problem. And so that it does not need to be that way. And so join us in SWI. We're all over that topic. We're all about teaching you not only mechanics of Bible study and discipleship and all those important things, but also the practical issues of being a mom, being a wife, and a mother. And so we think it's that the Lord's using it in a fabulous way.
I'm a big believer, and let me tell you, all of a sudden, she says that extemporaneous speaking is not her gift, but you notice she got the commercial in twice with absolutely no forethought. So we're going to absolutely give her credit for that. We're out of time. And I want to go back to the text. This was not an opportunity for exposition, but I want to go back to Jesus and the boat with those disciples. And let me point out, you often hear people preach this text, and I think they misteach it. Because they'll point to the disciples and say, hey, they weren't really in any trouble. Jesus was in the boat. Yeah, but you know, if you were in the boat, it sure looks like you were in big trouble. There'll be a lot of times in ministry where you're going to face some waves. And again, this is not a gloom and doom suggestion. There are going to be some who are going to face earth-shaking crises. But you know what? Jesus is in the boat. And at the end of it all, at Southern Seminary, I want to tell you, we can say together, who is this that both the winds and the waves obey him? God bless you all. We're praying for you. Thank you.